Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Chills at Will podcast. I'm Pete Real. I'm an English and Spanish teacher at the high school level. I'm an aspiring writer and I'm a voracious reader. Thank you so much for listening. This episode deals with righteous anger, a growing anger, a justified anger, an anger that is quite apparent as protests roll out streets over the grotesque and senseless murders of George Floyd, Andres Carrillo, Breonna Taylor, Elijah McClain, and so many more men and women of color at the hands of law enforcement. If you haven't already, please go back and listen to episode 10, which dealt with righteous and justified anger as seen through Langston Hughes' poem, The Colored Soldier. Think of this episode as part two, a continuation of the saga of American racism and its cumulative effects on all of us, as seen through literature. I read Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man as a senior in high school, and its effects on me are numerous and long-lasting. The famous, or perhaps infamous, Battle Royal scene is a masterpiece in its own right, an analog of the scene I described in episode 1 where my brother finished S.E. Hinton's That Was Then, This Is Now, threw the book against the wall, and stared, unmoving for what seemed like 5 minutes. Speaking of Ellison's Invisible Man, the focus of this episode, the book's prologue is from the nameless narrator's life, an invisible life, where he states, quote, "I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me," end quote. He feels that, as an amalgam of so many stereotypes, the product is a sense of invisibility. With all of its advantages and its many disadvantages. The narrator starts the first chapter, pretty much referred to in the canon as the Battle Royal chapter, and I will often refer to it in this episode as the Battle Royal chapter. The first chapter starts off with the narrator describing how his grandpa gave a startling speech on his deathbed. The grandfather was supposed to have been the classic, keep your head down, work hard type of guy, but instead, on his deathbed, he talked about, quote, "Son, after I'm gone, I want you to keep up the good fight. I never told you, but our life is a war, and I've been a traitor all my born days. A spy in the enemy's country ever since I gave up my gun back in the Reconstruction. Live with your head in the lion's mouth. I want you to overcome them with yeses, undermine them with grins, agree them to death and destruction. Let them swallow you till they vomit or bust wide open." They thought the old man had gone out of his mind. He had been the meekest of men. End quote. The narrator lives out this advice in spite of himself, talking about the strangeness of this style of meek living being treacherous, according to his grandpa. And again, I quote from the narrator, who says, "When I was praised for my conduct, I felt a guilt that in some way I was doing something that was really against the wishes of white folks, that if they had understood, they would have desired me to act just the opposite, that I should have been sulky and mean, and that really would have been what they wanted, even though they were fooled and though they wanted me to act as I did. It made me afraid that someday they would look upon me as a traitor and I would be lost. Still, I was more afraid to act any other way because they didn't like that at all. The old man's words were like a curse." End quote. The narrator wins the award. We get the impression, I believe that he's in, you know, probably a late high school, maybe a senior in high school. He wins an award for oratory in which he talks about humility as the key to growth and as the key to cooperation and everyone getting along. His speech is indeed a source of pride for the whole community. Moving on in the book, he then very matter-of-factly talks about the battle royal that will be held before the speech. Basically, he goes, he's prepared to go to this ballroom, to the hotel to give his speech, and just kind of throws in there that he's asked to be part of the battle royal since it's going to be held right before his speech anyway. The narrator gets there and he talks about how he isn't too keen for the battle royal. And I quote, "Not from a distaste for fighting, but because I didn't care too much for the other fellows who were to take part. They were tough guys who seemed to have no grandfather's curse worrying their minds. No one could mistake their toughness. And besides, I suspected that fighting a battle royal might detract from the dignity of my speech. In those pre-invisible days, I visualized myself as a potential Booker T. Washington. But the other fellows didn't care too much for me either, and there were 9 of them. I felt superior to them in my way, and I didn't like the manner in which we were all crowded together in the servants' elevator. Nor did they like my being there. In fact, as the warmly lighted floors flashed past the elevator, we had words over the fact that I, by taking part in the fight, had knocked one of their friends out of a night's work." End quote. If you haven't already assumed, the 10 who are participating in the Battle Royal are all African American. These are all black youth. "I am struck by the insidiousness, the all-encompassing nature of a racist society, such that the narrator is not at first resistant to the fighting for reasons of exploitation at the hands of the white men, but instead he directs his distaste towards his fellow black youth. White supremacy has created a tiered society where, with the top tiers reserved for white men and women, the exploited are often made to feel like those on the bottom with them are the ones who need to be attacked. The banquet hall where the battle royal is taking place is populated, according to the narrator, with, quote, some of the most important men of the town, and they were quite tipsy. They were all there, bankers, lawyers, judges, doctors, fire chiefs, teachers, merchants, even one of the more fashionable pastors," end quote. The narrator notes that there is a commotion up front and that the school superintendent, the very person who invited the narrator to speak at the event, calls for the boys, using a racial slur, for them to be brought up into the fight area. Further humiliating and degrading the boys, the men bring them into the area of the commotion, where a naked white woman dances suggestively for the hooting and hollering and drunk crowd. This is Lord of the Flies. This is men's basic and basest instincts come to the fore. And we as a reader are well aware by now that the narrator was invited there to be part of the spectacle, part of the show, not to be respected for his intellect. The narrator expresses his conflicted emotions, strong ones that match the chaotic and hyped atmosphere, and I quote, "I felt a wave of irrational guilt and fear. My teeth chattered, my skin turned to goose flesh, my knees knocked. Yet I was strongly attracted and looked in spite of myself. Had the price of looking been blindness, I would have looked. I felt a desire to spit upon her as my eyes brushed slowly over her body. I wanted at one and the same time to run from the room, to sink through the floor, or go to her and cover her from my eyes and the eyes of the others with my body, to feel the soft thighs, to caress her and destroy her, to love her and to murder her, to hide from her." End quote. I'm reminded of the 1920s, and of course this time period unfortunately was not the only one, but in the 1920s in which owning African arts and crafts gained newfound cachet for rich and fashionable white people, while African Americans themselves, the descendants of Africa, while they themselves were still decades away from even nominal voting rights and overall equal rights by law. I'm reminded of Sammy Davis Jr., an incredible performer, comedian, dancer, actor, who would absolutely pack hotels and entertainment venues, making fortunes for the hotels, yet the man couldn't even eat in the main restaurant with the rest of the Rat Pack. In his autobiography, Yes, I Can, Davis wrote of the stark contrast between how he was warmly greeted in showrooms while he faced segregation in the hotels where he played. Las Vegas Strip hotels did not allow African-American customers and entertainers of the post-war era to reside in or patronize the hotel casinos. Black performers entered and exited through kitchens, and sometimes were lucky to get a meal at the places where they performed. They stayed in boarding houses or motels in racially segregated West Los Angeles. West Las Vegas. I'm reminded of Colin Kaepernick, forced out of the NFL, treated like damaged goods by tentative owners who didn't want to alienate their fan base. This Colin Kaepernick, who's still unsigned 4 years after getting run out of the NFL simply because he kneeled for the national anthem. This man went from hero one day, a dynamic quarterback who came within a few plays of winning the Super Bowl in 2013, to a zero the next, even though he clearly stated that his protest was against police brutality, not against the country as a whole. It was against racial profiling of people of color. Even though he so wanted his message to be pure that he talked to former Army Green Beret Nate Boyer about his protest, with Boyer advising him to take a knee. I'm reminded of Chris Jackson, formerly Chris Jackson, known as Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, who refused to pledge allegiance, so to speak, who refused to quote-unquote respect the national anthem in the late 1990s in the NBA. He played for the Denver Nuggets. To force anybody to be patriotic, to force anyone to be patriotic, seemingly doesn't make sense. It's seemingly nonsensical. To make an African American, to force an African American to be patriotic, why? How? How is that even something that we feel we can do? African art, Sammy Davis Jr., Colin Kaepernick, Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, the list goes on and on and on. Those of African descent are often good enough to make money for our businesses and Fortune 500 companies and good enough to provide entertainment for the masses. But when it comes to equal treatment, when it comes to having a voice and calling for rights and an end to racism, well, to paraphrase the dastardly Laura Ingraham, shut up and dribble, shut up and dance, shut up and throw the football, shut up and provide me with amusement. It is this entertainment that the black youth provide for the white man of the community in Invisible Man, in the Battle Royal chapter. The naked woman, too, is entertainment, and as the men get progressively more drunk, the rowdiness and tumult grows to a fever pitch. Drinks are spilled, tables are toppled, and the woman is chased, grabbed, and even tossed in the air before she is helped to her escape by a few sober men. One plaything is gone, but 10 other boy playthings will be sticking around. After the unyielding embarrassment and torture of being presented with a writhing naked woman, the boys are taken into the ring to fight, many of them by this point hysterical and crying. All 10 fighters are told that there is one particular boy who must be taken down, and that failure to do so will lead to the white man himself attacking the boy. This is the classic, like, out of a Bugs Bunny cartoon, you know, saying like, hey, Jimmy, Frank said you're weak and he's going to beat you up. Hey, Frank, Jimmy, you get my point. One is basically every man for himself. The boys are blindfolded and a flailing of limbs and absolute free-for-all ensues. This further shows the boys as powerless, their anger turned not against their oppressors but against the closest and easiest targets, themselves. The narrator describes his blindfolded self as like a baby or a drunk man with no dignity, mirroring the treatment of African Americans by society at large. As the anarchy continues, the narrator still with illusions of being treated like an intellectual peer, finds himself practicing his speech, wondering if he'll be accepted by the men recognized for his skill. A tacit approval by the boys leaves the narrator and only one fighter in the ring, where the narrator whispers a bribe to the boy if he will just fake a knockout. The boy, Tatlock, refuses, denying that he wants to win to impress these white men, but instead doing it solely for himself. The white man in this scene, much like the white men of our country's history, have used divide and conquer rottenly well. The narrator hears a man in the crowd say that his money is on Tatlock, and the narrator is caught off guard, wondering if seeking to prove the man wrong and getting vengeance on Tatlock would go against the ideas of humility he wrote about in his speech. Tatlock knocks him down and out as the narrator is further dazed and bloodied, and he describes his eye feeling like a jack-in-the-boxes, his thoughts scattered. I remember reading this chapter, the infamous Battle Royal, and being enthralled by such incredible writing and disgusted by the actions of the men. And I couldn't believe it when one misery was not, in fact, the last misery, when the tortures continued and continued. In this case, the misery was not over after the Battle Royal. The boys were told that they would now be paid, and the money, their money, is thrown onto the carpets that are brought out, and these carpets happen to be electrified. The boys are lab animals, forced to hurt themselves and others in pursuit of a few bucks, which later turn out to be basically counterfeit or worthless. "This ought to be good," one man says, as the rugs and money are set up. The show is about to continue. The men hoot and holler and taunt and deride, and the boys, according to the narrator, were, quote, "laughing in fear and embarrassment," end quote. There is something that makes me as a reader truly cringe, an almost literal physical reaction that mimics that of the chattering teeth and jangled nerves that accompany the boys scampering for the money. I know very well that singular laugh that comes when one is ashamed, embarrassed, or scared. I want you to think of a time where you were laughing, but you were far from happy or amused. Though I will never have any idea what it is like to be abused and tortured and disrespected so thoroughly because of my race, I can empathize with these uncomfortable laughs and wounded emotions due to Ellison's brilliant imagery and tactical writing. Mr. Colcord, I guess it is, a quote-unquote respected man of the town because, hey, he owns movie and entertainment houses. He pulls at the narrator's leg when the narrator attempts to avoid some of the pain by grabbing onto a chair leg. This man, Mr. Colcord, even ends up kicking the narrator with a laugh of contempt, grotesquely pleased to see a black boy squirm. Finally, the boys are told to stop, to get dressed, to grab up all their money. Given the $5 that all the boys received except for Tatlock, who got twice as much, the narrator is in great physical and emotional pain, walking out of this ballroom, figuring that he is not to give his speech. He is stopped and told to go back, where the MC, as if no blood had just been shed a few minutes before, a few feet away, the MC announces the speech, along with his patronizing words, and I quote, "I'm told that he is the smartest boy we've got out there in Greenwood. I'm told that he knows more big words than a pocket-sized dictionary," end quote. These loaded sentences, which in 26 words managed to mark the narrator as a, quote, boy, perhaps or perhaps not meant in the loaded and derogatory sense of the word, but it's hard to give him the benefit of the doubt. And he also manages to mark the narrator as different and less than due to living, quote, "out there in Greenwood," end quote. The narrator is tense, nervous, pained, sweating, and ill at ease. And some men continue to yell for him to speak louder after he has started, while others laugh and talk as if there is no speaker at all. The speech starts with the extended metaphor of casting your nets where you are, as in the line that exemplifies the speech's theme of humility and acceptance. The narrator says, quote, "To those of my race who depend on bettering their condition in a foreign land, or who underestimate the importance of cultivating friendly relations with a southern white man, who is his next-door neighbor, I would say, cast down your bucket where you are. Cast it down in making friends in every manly way of the people of all races by whom we are surrounded." End quote. As his speech continues, he is literally drooling and swallowing blood. But he keeps going due to his earnest belief in the rightness of his message. In a well-placed and telling aside, the narrator, looking back many years, writes, quote, "What powers of endurance I had during those days! What enthusiasm! What a belief in the rightness of things!" End quote. In his scramble to control some of the many conflicting emotions and external forces, he fails to register the alarm that has sounded in the listener's head when he is asked to repeat a heady phrase from his speech. It was originally social responsibility, but after repeating and slowly enunciating the word responsibility a few times, he slips up and he says, "Equality, as in social equality." Ellison crafts skillful awkwardness in these following lines, and I quote, "The laughter hung smoke-like in the sudden stillness. I opened my eyes, puzzled. Sounds of displeasure filled the room. The MC rushed forward. They shouted hostile phrases at me, but I did not understand. A small, dry, mustached man in the front row blared out, 'Say that slowly, son.' 'What, sir?' 'What you just said.' 'Social responsibility, sir,' I said. 'You weren't being smart, were you, boy?' he said, not unkindly. 'No, sir.' 'You sure that about equality was a mistake?' 'Oh, yes, sir,' I said. I was swallowing blood. 'Well, you better speak more slowly so we can understand. We mean to do right by you, but you've got to know your place at all times. All right now, go on with your speech.' I was afraid. I wanted to leave, but I also wanted to speak, and I was afraid they'd snatch me down. 'Thank you, sir,' I said, beginning where I'd left off, and having them ignore me as before." End quote. There is something so sinister and instructive about the mustache man saying, according to Ellison, according to the narrator, "You weren't being smart, were you?" And Ellison adds, "But not unkindly. But not unkindly." This says so much about the accepted social mores and racial caste system of the time. The man was, in a perverse way, not being mean or rude or racist. He was simply reminding the narrator of what both knew to be true. Black people, the mustache man reminds the narrator, and by extension, the reader also knows, that black people need to know their place. It just makes everything easier. And there is for me a special sadness in having this narrator having to lower himself by saying, "Thank you, sir," after being reminded that he must, quote, "know his place at all times." And he's still apologetic. As a white man, I will never understand what it is to be a person of color in our society. and particularly to be a black man in a white supremacist society, I'm aware intellectually of the idea of the white gaze. The white gaze is defined as the assumption that the reader is white and the resulting self-consciousness in your thinking and writing, as described by writer L.J. Alonge. Again, I am aware of the idea of the white gaze, and that is defined as the assumption that the reader is white and the resulting self-consciousness in reading, in thinking and writing. This intellectual awareness can only get me so far, but so too can I understand as much as possible this idea of the white gaze because of the way that Ellison so adroitly frames this scene. We as readers can hear the laughter, the drunken banter, the insults, the crassness, and we can imagine being the narrator, looking out into this sea of gatekeepers, wanting to run away, wanting to break down crying, wanting to attack physically or verbally these agitators. This white gaze is strong. This white gaze is fixed, and this white gaze is exacting. This chapter's ending reinforces the idea that this story within a story, this description of the battle royal in the speech, could work by itself as a separate entity, its own short story. It is an ending that I have not since forgotten since I read it some 21 years ago in a hot senior English classroom. I quote now, starting right after the speech has ended, and the superintendent has praised the narrator and presented him with a gleaming new briefcase. Again, I quote, "Boy," he said, addressing me, "boy, take this prize and keep it well. Consider it a badge of office. Prize it. Keep developing as you are, and someday it will be filled with important papers that will help shape the destiny of your people." I was so moved that I could hardly express my thanks. A rope of bloody saliva forming a shape like an undiscovered continent drooled upon the leather, and I wiped it quickly away. I felt an importance that I had never dreamed. "Open it and see what's inside," I was told. My fingers a-tremble, I complied, smelling fresh leather and finding an official-looking document inside. It was a scholarship to the State College for Negroes. My eyes filled with tears and I ran awkwardly off the floor. I was overjoyed. I did not even mind when I discovered the gold pieces I had scrambled for were brass pocket tokens, advertising a certain make of automobile. When I reached home, everyone was excited. Next day, the neighbors came to congratulate me. I even felt safe from grandfather, whose deathbed curse usually spoiled my triumphs. I stood beneath his photograph with my briefcase in hand and smiled triumphantly into his stolid black peasant's face. It was a face that fascinated me. The eyes seemed to follow everywhere I went. That night I dreamed I was at a circus with him and that he refused to laugh at the clowns no matter what they did. Then later he told me to open my briefcase and read what was inside, and I did, finding an official envelope stamped with the state seal. And inside the envelope I found another and another, endlessly, and I thought I would fall of weariness. "Them's years," he said, "now open that one." And I did, and in it I found an engraved stamp containing a short message in letters of gold. "Read it," my grandfather said, "out loud." "To whom it may concern," I intoned, "keep this N-word boy running." I awoke with the old man's laughter ringing my ears. End quote. Truly visceral, in line with the mission and philosophy of this podcast, the visceral beauty of literature. I picked this excerpt and I picked this book for this episode on righteous and justified anger because in tandem with Langston Hughes' 1919 poem about the horrific mistreatment of African American soldiers, we get an idea of how little has changed in the 30 plus years between the colored soldier poem and Invisible Man. And for that matter, in the 65 to 70 years or so since Invisible Man to today, 2020, we see a growing anger, a festering anger, a why haven't things changed anger. And it is this anger that grows and is shaped throughout the rest of the novel, which is launched by this incredibly explosive first chapter. We see the accumulation of racism over years and years in the different texts that we read, such that Native American writer Sherman Alexie described what could be said of his Spokane Coeur d'Alene people, as well as many other people of color and definitely of African Americans. Sherman Alexie described it as, "We cry old tears." The narrator of The Invisible Man, oh boy, sorry, this is not W.C. Fields' The Invisible Man, this is Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. The narrator of Invisible Man stands on the shoulders of so many who came before him, including, of course, his grandpa. He stands on these shoulders, he looks down at so many dried tears. He's a person in so many ways who is trapped by his brilliance. Those who can give him some sort of reassurance, some fame, some credit, are also the ones who will not hesitate to have him fight for their entertainment, check him when he even dares to mention equality, and keep him running as he tries to find out who he is and where he is. When he thinks that he is an esteemed student, an esteemed orator, he is run into and around a boxing ring, bloodied and shamed. When he thinks he isn't being heard, he's troubled. When he finds out that he is being heard, vaguely, he finds out that his cage is very tight. When he thinks humility is the way to go, he finds out that aggression is the rule. But this aggression that can only be shown at the right time and for the right people. In the end, though, the narrator's grandpa might say, the clowns from the dream are those people who think that they are anything more than entertainment, that their lives matter as much as those of the white ringmaster, and that the bearded woman and the elephant man, thinking that they will eat dinner at the same table as a circus owner, are hopelessly and stupidly delusional. And in the end, there is the grandfather, ending the chapter in the same way as he started the chapter. In this case, his eyes seemingly following his grandson from the photograph on the wall, this photograph representative of ancestors, of history, of sharecroppers, of slavery and toil. And this photograph, this grandfather in the photograph is laughing at him, dismissive of the narrator's misguided, naive thoughts that the American dream is for the black man too. And of course we are reminded of the naivete of Langston Hughes' brother, who died so senselessly fighting for his country, as we talked about in the last episode from the poem, The Colored Soldier. If you learn history through nonfiction, through poetry like The Colored Soldier, and through epic fiction like Invisible Man, how can you not acknowledge and recognize and affirm this righteous and justified anger? Thank you for listening to today's episode. The music from the episode is Childish Gambino's 2018 song, This Is America. Childish Gambino is on RCA Records. Please spread the word about the Chills at Will podcast, passing it on to somebody who you know will enjoy it. I have huge news this week, and that news is that the Chills at Will podcast is now on Apple Podcasts. That's right. You can search by podcast name and find this podcast, the Chills at Will podcast. And I hope that you will subscribe, and I hope that you'll leave a 5-star review with comments if you are so moved. You can also talk to Alexa. Alexa, play the Chills at Will podcast.
Playing chill.
All right, Alexa chill. Didn't quite chill. From Apple comply. Podcasts. Let's try it again. Alexa, play the Chills at Will podcast.
I couldn't find Chills at Will.
Alexa, play the Chills at Will podcast.
Playing the Chills at Will podcast from Apple Podcasts.
Hey, third time's the charm.
From where you left off. To listen to the newest episode, ask me to play the latest.
Alexa, play the latest episode.
Getting the Chills at Will podcast from Apple Podcasts. Playing the latest episode, episode 10, part 1. Righteous Anger and Langston Hughes, the Colored Soldier.
Alexa, stop. Folks, I proved it to you. So please, use Alexa. And you're so welcome for saving you some movement to even go to your computer or your phone to play it. Please go to Apple Podcasts, search for the Chills at Will podcast. You can also find me, Pete Real, on Facebook and Instagram, at Chills at Will Podcast, all one word, and on Twitter, at Chills at Will, P-O, the number one. This podcast is a one-man job. It's a labor of love, and I'd appreciate you recommending it to any like-minded friends and loved ones. Until next time, my hope is that you continue to find that writing that gives you chills at Will. Come on.